There are a lot of constants to gardening, choosing the right plants for our growing conditions and then keeping them watered, fed, hopefully weed-free. Having a small space to garden in can actually mean less upkeep, and it doesn't have to mean that it's a less satisfying or beautiful display. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in this week for Larry Mueller. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for another edition of Garden Talk. Whether you're a new gardener or an old hand, it's great to be able to get advice from the experts. Ed Lyon is the director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus, and he's been with us many times on Garden Talk. Ed, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Well, happy spring.
Happy spring. It's kind of almost sort of feeling a little springish out there.
Well, it at least looks like it might be possible now.
It does. Yeah, for a long time there, I just thought the polar vortex was going to park over us and never leave.
Yeah, and it isn't funny how this is the first time I've ever even heard the term polar vortex.
Yes.
We seem to be creating weather terminology.
Well, actually, our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, said that that has always been a term, but it just has never really impacted us in the way that it had over and over and over this year. So that's why it's a new term to us, but the meteorologists have been all over it.
Well,
years.
Let's hope we don't hear it again
exactly.
Anytime
let's
soon.
Let's hope it fades into the background. Well, we have so much to talk about, as always, and you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or a garden photo. We'd love to see some of those right about now on the Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And Ed, I just noticed that we are at 6,955 fans on Facebook. Larry is back on Monday. I bet he would love to see us top 7,000 by then. So if you're on Facebook and if you love listening to the show and you haven't quite clicked on that like yet, why don't you do that? That'll be a nice surprise for Larry coming back on Monday after his wonderful trip to Hawaii. Sounds like they had some great experiences there, including some amazing gardens, not surprisingly. I don't know how many of those Hawaiian plants would do well in a Wisconsin garden, though.
They'd be in a greenhouse right now, I think.
Right. And, well, actually, talking about specialty gardens, you and your volunteer, Ed Glover, talked on the show about the Rock and Alpine Gardens at Allen Centennial Gardens a while back. Tell us about some of the other specialty gardens that you have.
Well, we actually have 26 individually themed gardens within the 2.5 acres, which is rather hard to believe. And obviously, some are larger than others. But we kind of go the gamut of showing historical perspective. So some of our specialty gardens aren't necessarily what we would advocate that you put in your backyard, but it shows the history of design. For instance, your English, your French, your Italian style gardens. But then it runs the gamut to a Wisconsin woodland garden where all the plants out there are native to Wisconsin, and you can see the spring beauties come up in the spring. So we try to show in a very small space the very wide variety of not only ways to garden, but styles of garden, garden design. Probably the area that's grown the largest recently has been anything to do with edibles. And what used to be our kitchen garden is now expanded out into our terrace. And limited space gardening, when you talk about small gardening spaces, this is huge right now. So it includes things like square foot garden beds, vertical gardening. It even gets into things as complex as rooftop gardens, living walls. We have portable screens. It's amazing for the gardener today with very, very limited space. And we joke because I think I've really I've brought in 3 more units, and I think I've filled the space.
Wow.
So if you want to come and see an enormous variety of different ways to grow in limited space, we're really trying to demonstrate that.
Well, and something that you said I really want to cue in on, you're not even just talking about using the horizontal space. Well, you're talking about a lot of vertical space, too.
Absolutely. And to go along with that, a lot of our – and most of this is geared towards edible gardening, vegetables, fruits, but certainly are usable in ornamental gardening as well. But we're just trying to demonstrate to people how they can do that. And vertical is a big thing now. A vine that used to take up more than its footprint deserved in a garden, we now have going up, 45-degree angle up some panels, and then you can plant something underneath it. So, and plant breeding is going along with it, too. There's a lot of breeding for more compact vegetables, vegetables to grow in containers. Mm-hmm. Some of my absolute favorite right now are the tomatoes, that trail. You can put them in a hanging basket. So they're hang them just like you would an ornamental on the porch, walk mm-hmm. out, and they're loaded with tomatoes, and pick them off. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing what we're doing in small spaces now.
I've seen a few really interesting photos recently. One was the kind of structure like an arbor where you would expect maybe grapevines or something like wisteria, and it had all kinds of squash and melons. And so they were hanging. I guess you wouldn't want them to get too ripe because they might fall on your head as you were walking uh-huh. under them. But, like you said, instead of those vines taking over a huge amount of real estate, they're going up and then forming their fruit.
We actually built what we call the gourd arbor last year. I had a local company that does all of our welding come mm-hmm. in. And this is an arbor that comes out of a raised bed. So that's 6 feet long and 2 feet wide. And then arches up and over a seeding area, comes down into another similar raised bed. So you can grow gourds, mini pumpkins, mm-hmm. things. You could do a vinings. And so they grow up and over from either side with only 2 feet wide of space. It's not even garden space on either side. And that looks really phenomenal when all the vines yeah. cover that
well, yeah,
over.
Actually, squash and all the varieties of squash have beautiful leaves and vines, and
they do. We made a mistake last year, though. We grew them on top of the netting, and then we did realize we had to cut holes where all the gourds would come through.
Oops.
But you learn.
You learn from your experiences. I also saw a couple of things. One was using gutters, but mounting gutters on a wall, and then using them as basically kind of flower boxes.
Yeah, and this is the vertical wall gardening, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of this happening now. In fact, I just did a talk for my volunteers showing a lot of these new things. And many of them are commercially oriented. I mean, I was just on a conference in Vancouver, and we went and visited a library where the entire side of the building was a living wall. The one thing I think that that gardeners have to realize, there are ways to create those things on your walls, and I've seen gutters mm-hmm. use, flower boxes, any number of them, but you also have to keep in mind what you're putting around. Are you putting it on clapboard?
Right.
The water runoff, these things become issues. They're wonderful things to do, but also be thinking about the consequences of watering. We have a number of what we call living screens. So these are actually vertical, and they're based on flower boxes mm-hmm. that go up either tiered or directly up and down on wheels. You get that same kind of effect. Since they're on casters, you can move them around and create different spaces with them. They're portable, and you're not damaging the house at mm-hmm. the same time.
Similarly, I saw it looked like the structure of if you were building stairs, so it was mm-hmm. it was a stair step thing without the risers in between, and then they just led up to basically a support. So they were almost like a ladder, except that on one side it was those stair steps, and then putting flower boxes on there to grow greens or anything else.
Yeah, and really big right now are pallets. Mm. Taking a pallet, putting it upright, you plant these pallets, the plants come out the side. The master gardeners here in Dane County have been doing a number of those. Those I found they're a little more difficult to water and keep evenly
sure.
moist, but that's always going to happen anytime you go vertical or any type of container. You're into a little bit more issues of how do we control water and keep things evenly moist. But a lot of different things out there. In fact, one of our volunteers built some pallet gardens for us. So you'll see pallet garden. And we try to represent all kinds of things. We go from a square foot gardening box you could build for less than $25 all the way up to one of our living screens is a $2,500 unit. But we want to show people all those various options to them out there.
We're talking with Ed Lyon. He is the director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. He's been there since 2008. And Allen Centennial Gardens, amazingly, is staffed by just one full-time person, that's Ed, plus volunteers and seasonal summer interns or seasonal student interns. It's 100% self-funded, including the salaries. It's not part of the operating budget of the university or the state, and they do some pretty amazing work considering all that. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones and Dean in Lake Geneva. Hi, Dean.
Hi. I had a quick question for you.
Sure.
My girlfriend wants to get into gardening again. And the first time around, she used flowers and they all died. And I really want to do something easy that's going to live. And she really wants to do vegetables or fruits, something edible. She wants to have a result at the end. So I was wondering, what's an easy vegetable or fruit plant that I can help her tend to that won't, it's more hardy, that won't die off on her?
And what kind of space do you have, Dean?
This would be like an apartment garden. So listening to the suggestions that your guest is making, I don't feel right calling
A container or soil?
Would it be in containers? Oh, okay, so right
so
in the
you,
dirt.
You do have soil. Well, the first and foremost thing is you want to test that soil and see what you need there. If that's where she was doing her gardening and the flowers are dying, the first indication is there's something wrong with the soils. And especially in any urban landscape, you're probably going to have to do some soil modification. Vegetables are all fairly easy and certainly multi-purpose. A lot of people like to do the vegetables because then they get use out of them as well. I'm thinking that if the soils are poor and compacted, why don't you look into building a square foot garden bed? I would highly recommend getting a book called The All New Square Foot Gardening Book. It's relatively inexpensive, soft cover. The author is Mel Bartholomew. We build our square foot gardening beds based on his designs. He gives you in there directions for a recipe for the growing media. And again, that's key to your success. Very cheap, easy to build. You could do the whole thing for under $50 for one 4x4. As you feel comfortable with one, then certainly add a few more. But they probably have been one of the most popular things that people have found at the gardens that they're replicating at home.
And the great thing about that, too, is that he, because he gives you such good instructions on how to make the soil really healthy and succession planning, you can actually grow a lot more than you think you could in that 4x4.
We actually have ours divided into 1x1 squares. So that gives you 16 squares. And we do that purposely with some wood so that when people come in, they look at it like, oh, my Lord, 16 squares. That means mm-hmm. I can put a lot of different plants in here. So that's what I would recommend. That's a relatively cheap investment. If you follow the directions and put in that you'll be able to do most any kind of smaller scale vegetable in there to get started. Obviously, don't start with a great big old zucchini who's going right. to you know take the whole thing. But
right. And also, Dean, there was something that Ed was telling me before the show, and I wanted to make sure we talked about it on air so everyone could benefit from this. A lot of us are interested in growing heirloom vegetables because they have wonderful tastes and very different tastes and they're beautiful, but they're often not very hardy. And Ed said that there's a great new solution for that.
So we did it for the first time last year. It's relatively new, although they've been doing it in Japan for years and years and years. And these are called grafted tomatoes. And one of the issues when we go back to using some of the old heirlooms and old varieties to get that flavor again is they're highly susceptible to a lot of the disease. So they're now grafting a certain number of vegetables. It's mostly tomatoes, but last year we also did eggplants and peppers. Now, for those of you who are used to going out and buying the $1.29 tomato plant, they're pricey. Grafting an annual like that's only going to last a single season, is going to, I paid anywhere from $9 to $12 a plant. However, and I did it with trepidation. Some of my garden writing friends said, oh, yes, you know, we've done it and I'm very happy with the results. And I have to say, I think you'll buy less tomato plants as a result. Ours turned into the tomatoes turned into absolute bushes. They went into fall totally green, not any type of disease issue, yielded enormously with wonderful, flavorful heirlooms. So I look into that if any of you are having issues with diseases. Again, it's a little higher investment than what you're probably used to when you start out. I bought mine online. There's a number of companies. The one I went through, the plants came so well packed. I ordered from them again this year. They're called Mighty Tomatoes. But you're going to start seeing these grafted vegetables showing up in your local garden centers as well.
What are some of the heirloom varieties that they are grafting out?
Oh, there is a large number of them. One of my favorites is Indigo Rose. It's a purple one that's very high in anthocyanin. That one was grafted, but you'll find, I bet there were 30, 40 different tomatoes that they have
just
grafted.
Just the tomatoes.
Just
and then
the tomatoes.
And then you said eggplants and peppers.
We did eggplants and peppers, and I would expect, and I expect you'll see a lot more of this now that it's becoming trendy.
We are talking with Ed Lyon. He is director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Right now, we're getting great information from Ed Lyon, the director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. And Ed, why don't we go back to the phone and Ruth in Ladysmith. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was down there at the Allen Gardens a couple of years ago, and it was an unplanned visit, so I was there like in late fall, and there wasn't a whole lot going on. And I have a few questions. Is your remodeling of the building all done?
No.
No.
No, but
okay.
It's all, the exterior is finished, other than a ramp they're putting into the back. But the interior, no.
Okay. I wondered, what is your favorite season at the gardens? Because I want to come when it's really booming.
You asking my favorite season?
Mm-hmm.
My favorite season is every day I'm there.
Oh, okay.
So, I tell people when they ask, and people ask all the time, if I'm only going to visit once, and we know if you visit once, you're going to come back. When they ask if I'm only going to visit once, it depends on what you're interested in. Some people love the exuberant spring display of bulbs, and that's what they, you know, they live and breathe for, those wonderful displays, and we do them. And boy, it's hard to tell anybody since we haven't had an average spring in years and years, but usually that's your first 2 weeks of May. They're usually peaking somewhere about mid-May. And again, that's varied tremendously the last few years with both early springs and late springs. But if that's the kind of thing you like, with, you know, thousands of tulips, and every year we do different color themes and every bed is different, that is certainly a time to come. And then the other sort of splashy time is your late summer season, end of July into August. That's obviously when all of our vegetables, the annuals, the tropicals, they're reaching all of their full growth. They're at their full bloom. But I think my favorite season is fall. I really love, it's that time of year when the light changes. So just walking through a garden, everything takes on sort of a different look.
I think the light is warmer.
Yeah,
in the fall. There's a warmth to it that I really
there
love.
Is, and you know, the things that are changing color, the foliage that's changing color, but obviously we like to think that most any time that you visit, there's always something to see, even when we're transitioning those seasonal beds of bulbs into the annuals, that we have, you know, all the perennials and trees and shrubs. So we think there's something there to see all the time.
Can I ask two more questions?
Sure.
Okay. Are your volunteers only students from the university?
Oh, absolutely not. We have a group of volunteers who, you know, are members of the community, just like any public garden. They are our lifeblood. There's no way around it. We're very proud that we're able to raise all the funds for that garden and offer it free to the public, and there's no way we could do it without the dedication of these wonderful volunteers that we have.
And I'm sure they learn a lot as well while they're doing it.
They do, and as part of one of the things that we do, we know that people come to volunteer for us to learn more about gardening, and we get busy. They might come in one day, and what they're doing is weeding. And we don't always have that, and they come in, different ones come in at different times. So one of the things that we do, we offer our volunteers and our members, we have a member program in the winter from January up until the 1st of May, I do classes on Saturday mornings. Hmm. And so that's, if you're a member of Allen Centennial Gardens or a volunteer, and this year, for the first time, we've had guest speakers. It's not just me. Jeff Epping from Obrick,
oh, sure.
Mark Dwyer from Rotary Gardens, Mike Maddox. They're helping us out as well.
All so, Garden Talk guests.
Yeah. For us, we want our volunteers to be able to be learning about gardening year-round. So even when there's snow on the ground, we're all still together and we're still learning about gardening.
That's when we need it most sometimes, that sense of hope. Go ahead, Ruth.
I had one more question.
Sure.
You did mention tropicals. Do you have any tropical-looking things there that are perennials that look, you know, tropical? Because my daughter is trying to make such a garden, and I don't know if she's found things.
You know, our tropicals all go into a greenhouse for the winter. There are plants that can give you a tropical look. Certainly anything with very large, bold foliage, colorful foliage, things of this nature. But for the really true tropical, you're going to have to go with plants that are actually from the tropics and obviously aren't hardy. There is one banana that is supposed to be hardy to a zone 5. I haven't tried it yet. And some friends of mine have managed to do it, but you really have got to mulch over it very heavy. Needs to be up near the house. But overall, the best way to get that tropical look is the good thing is today the tropical plants you buy aren't really that much more expensive than annuals. They used to be cost prohibitive. Mm-hmm. So you can grow them a season and throw them away. You don't have to worry about finding ways to overwinter them. And they grow so quickly. You put a banana plant that's only a foot tall in the ground in the spring, and it'll be over your head by the end of summer.
Wow.
So we do a lot of things like the cardoon and bananas, elephant ears, many of these plants. You look at them in the spring in a little 4-inch pot, and you have no idea they're going to be these massive plants by the end of the season.
There's a reason the jungle looks the way it does, right? Thanks so much for that call, Ruth. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We are talking with Ed Lyon from the Allen Centennial Gardens. Let's go next to Platteville and Ann. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I would like to know if your guest has any experience with straw bale gardening. I think I heard about it on this program, actually.
I think you might be right.
And then I also did some reading about it. So I just wondered about his experience.
Sure. Yeah, we had Joel Karsten, who originated the straw bale gardening system, on the show a couple of times, I think, actually.
And it was recently in the New York Times. And so it's been around forever. But then you get articles like that. I have a very good friend who lives out in western Wisconsin. He started his vegetable garden that way, sitting on solid sand. That was maybe the easiest way to do it. And I just completed, I'm writing a book and just completed a section about straw bale gardening in that. To me, straw bale gardening is most useful for people in urban areas. They're sitting on concrete, asphalt. They have no soil to work with. So it's very easy to bring in these large blocks of what's basically organic matter. It takes a long time to soak them. They have to be thoroughly soaked sometimes.
Yeah, you have to condition them with fertilizer and things like that.
And keep in mind, all a straw bale garden is the same thing that a lasagna garden is. It's the same thing as a raised bed garden. You're just starting with a lot of compost. If you're in our area, there's probably no point in starting with a straw bale. You might as well do lasagna gardening, mm-hmm, or a raised bed. The problem with your straw bales is when you're putting these components together of organic matter, you should be doing 2 units of carbon to one unit of nitrogen. And you have to realize straw is entirely the carbon. So as it degrades, you're going to have to add fertility to get the nitrogen in there. If you're starting right out with a lasagna garden or a raised bed, you're already putting in the components to give you the proper ratios of carbon to nitrogen in the first place.
And for some people who don't know what lasagna gardening is, it's a layered, basically creating a layered compost pile that you then plant right into.
Exactly. And I joke, I say all straw bale gardening and lasagna gardening are raised beds without the, the solid
sides. Without the bed part, yeah.
But they're all very similar. Mm-hmm. And they can work very well in certain applications. And again, like I said, with a straw bale, it's very easy for people who are trying to do something on asphalt, concrete. But if you're already working on soil, to me, then just go out and get all of the really great ingredients and either do a raised bed or a lasagna garden. And we had a lasagna garden at Allen for 2 years, and they're now putting a ramp to the house where that sat. And so I said, well, I'm not going to lose all, you know, what we had in the lasagna garden. So I took all of that out. In just 2 years, I was pulling out stuff that was, all I could describe it as, is black gold. It was just wonderful.
Right.
So certainly if straw bales are the only way that you can really effectively begin a garden, it's a useful way to do it. But my advice is to go raised or lasagna first.
And the other thing, too, is that the straw bale, I think, for the most part, only lasts for one season.
Well, it's going to, it's going to decompose.
Whereas with the lasagna and the raised bed, you can keep it going. You'll have to keep adding things, but you're not starting from scratch every year.
And the straw allows you to start, but then you want to start adding some of these other composts that you'd be building these other gardens with to begin with.
Does that help, Ann?
Yes, one quick question.
Sure.
The thing that I had read was that you didn't have to weed with the straw bale.
In my book, one of the things I say is I hate the word easy. It's used way too often. And the other one is when we try to tell people that they're not going to have weeds. And that is a fallacy, no matter what type of gardening that you're looking at. I would say 85 to 90% of the weeds that you're going to deal with all come from the air. So to think that weed seeds aren't going to be dropped by the wind, by birds, or anything on top of a straw bale and take off like they would anywhere else is a total fallacy. Obviously, any type of these gardens, raised type of gardens, they're going to be easier to weed because you're working in really good quality organic matter. But don't let anybody ever tell you that there's any such thing as weed-free gardening.
I think part of it, too, is it's a smaller space.
So it's more control.
Right, and you see them right away, and it takes, you know, a minute or two to grab all those little weeds instead of looking out across this huge garden and thinking, yikes, where did all those come from?
But that's also true of a raised bed or lasagna garden, any form of gardening like that. You may get less weeds initially as that straw is breaking down, but it ultimately becomes organic matter, and weeds love organic matter.
Don't we all?
Everything loves that.
Thanks for that call, Ann. And actually, Susan in Duluth has a follow-up to the straw bale gardening issue, so let's go there. Hi, Susan.
Hello. This is so interesting. I did try hay bale gardening last year, and I used 30 bales of hay, and it was so successful, and I think because there's so much nutrition in hay compared with straw.
It's funny because I tell people I would use hay over straw because I'm a former farmer. And we all know if it's true straw, if it's an oat or wheat straw, it's very heavy in lignin. It's very shiny. It retards water from soaking into it. It's very hard to soak it in. Takes a long time, much longer time to break down. Any of us that have farmed and you get a good quality alfalfa hay, there's nitrogen in that. So you've already got more nitrogen than you do in the straw. Now, the argument that I've heard against hay is that it has weed seeds.
That's what I've heard as well.
Yeah, but guess where the weed seeds are? They're inside that bale. And as long as you're not breaking open that bale and exposing the seed to light, and if it's a good quality hay, an alfalfa type hay, and that's what I would recommend. Don't just go out and buy garbage, you know, hay. Mm-hmm. Good quality alfalfa is weed-free to begin with. A farmer doesn't want a whole bunch of weeds in alfalfa hay. And anytime I get hay, I buy it from our local co-op store because it comes in out of alfalfa fields. So what you're getting is pretty much solid alfalfa without the weeds. So I'm thinking that if you started with hay, you probably started with a good quality. And there's a real big difference there, because I think the people who don't advocate it for weeds is because it's probably some field, or maybe, you know, it's overgrown. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of weed plants in there, but I think that's an excellent point.
I started with poor quality hay because it was really cheap, and it worked great. And I think the thing is that it was, you know, when it's composting, it heats so much, it kills those seeds. I didn't have any weeds.
Yeah, as it is, what you'll do is, whether it's straw, hay, or a lasagna garden, it heats up to about 130 to 140 degrees. And you're right, it helps, it won't kill everything, but it kills off a, you know, large amount of things that might be issues for you down the line. And there is this little bit of waiting period. You want to wait till the temperatures drop back down to about 100 degrees. And when that happens, then you can start adding a little compost on top of those bales and then start planting right in the bales. But that could be as early as 2 weeks or so for those temperatures to drop back down.
Thanks so much for that call, Susan. It's always great when our listeners join in and add information, and we all learn something
we
that
sure
way.
Do.
You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're talking with Ed Lyon from the Allen Centennial Gardens. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller this week on Garden Talk. He will be back next week after his wonderful Hawaiian adventure with WPR listeners. So, Ed, we've talked about those specialty gardens, and I'm just dying to come out to Allen when things are getting started and see all those wonderful, you said 26 different themed gardens?
Correct.
In 2.5?
In 2.5 acres.
That's amazing. That's really inspiring. So for it to actually look like 26 themed gardens, besides the type of plants, how do you design those gardens to really give a sense of being set apart from maybe the theme right next to it?
Yeah, it's structure. And the original master plan of the garden, I applaud the original landscape architect, who was Dennis Bittner from Milwaukee. Mm. Many people may know Dennis. But he designed those gardens so it separated out, I guess the best way to describe it is almost like separate rooms. And it was contoured. That entire property was totally flat before they built it. Mm. So all the contour that you'll see when you come there was built into it. So you can be walking along one path and then enter through a large sheared hedge and walk into an entirely different environment. For instance, you might be walking in through a arborvitae sheared hedge where you're walking into the French and Italian garden. Takes you to a whole different place. Walk up a ramp and you walk into another area that's enclosed by a big yew hedge and you're in our English garden. So it's sort of dividing out everything, I think, is unified. Mm-hmm. But as you walk from area to area, we've tried to both with the physical structure and the plant materials give a different sense and feel. One of the things we hear very often is, one, we're very easy to negotiate. Mm-hmm. It's only 2.5 acres. But the other is it was designed so well that every space you can go into, you can almost feel a whole different mood in that space.
Do you do anything with, say, the mulch or, you know, what's around the plants to kind of help differentiate one garden from another? Or is that part of the continuity between them?
Not necessarily. Now, one year, we've done some succulents. And one year, there's a a recycled glass product that has been tumbled so it has no sharp edges. And we put that in around the succulents. It helps set them off. It draws in the heat. But overall, most of the mulch we use is pretty similar from garden to garden. And once all the plants are flushed out, you really
don't see it that much.
But in the same respect, obviously the rock garden is entirely different than any other area of the garden because the mulch, in quotation marks, is pea gravel. So that's a whole entirely different look. In fact, a lot of people come in and they see the, we have probably the largest and finest rock garden in the Midwest.
It's amazing.
And people don't understand it. And they're like, well, what is that large area over there with all the rocks and the gravel? But an alpine, it's representing alpine regions and would look very different. So, yeah, to a certain degree, the substrate or whatever you're using as mulches and things can affect as well.
And we have a picture of the crevice garden from the rock garden up on the Facebook page. And I just love it. It just has such an interesting feel to it.
This was something that a man from Czechoslovakia came up with. It's actually called a Czech crevice garden. Ours is based on one in Montreal that I understand is 2.5 acres. So if you can imagine our garden,
your
at two
garden,
and a half acres,
right.
It took a lot, 2 years to build the little crevice garden that we have. But it is to represent those alpine plants that would grow in crevices of rocks. And that's different than other areas of our rock garden. What we found with that, though, is this is a wonderful garden for the Midwest because it forces all those plants to put their roots deep. And key to survival for any plant in the Midwest is a deep root system. So I don't think we even really thought about that aspect. It was, you know, to create a unique environment and look. And we put all these what looks like sensitive plants in there, and we're finding they're actually doing better because it forces them to put their roots down deep.
Well, and I'm guessing, too, that the rocks also, as you were saying, like that polished glass, it'll hold in the heat, so it gives them a really...
Yes. In fact, the rock garden will... It represents alpine areas that bloom mostly in spring, and that will be our earliest garden to bloom. We'll actually, in a normal year... That garden will be colorful in April. It'll be colorful before the bulbs even come out.
Really? Yep. Wow.
And a lot of that probably has to do with the rocks and gravel drawing in more heat.
Talking with Ed Lyon from Allen Centennial Gardens, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in this week for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Ed Lyon from Allen Centennial Gardens on Garden Talk today. Ed, let's go back to the phones and Martha in Madison. Hi, Martha.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about potting soil. I have a big, big pot that I put my herbs in. It uses a lot of potting soil. Can I use it over and over, or what's the procedure?
You can. It's usually advisable to add to it, and I would have to know what the components and ingredients of your potting soil are. Most potting soils today are soilless, which means all the component, there's no soil in it at all. The problem with that is it also means that it doesn't retain much in the way of moisture. Your fertility drains right through as well. Both your mineral elements have a charge on them, and water has a charge. And the soilless mixes, none of those components have the opposite charge to attract them. And that's one of the qualities of soil, is that they have a charge that attracts those to them. So we've avoided a lot of diseases and overwatering issues by going to soilless mixes. But in the same regard, soil has a certain amount of advantage to it, too, as far as retaining that moisture and holding on to that fertility before it leaches entirely through. And everything degrades over time. So I would say, you know, maybe every 2 or 3 years, dump it out, you know, mix in some good compost. Compost itself degrades over time. That's where the word decomposition comes from. I think a lot of people don't realize, oh, I added compost to my garden, I won't have to do that again. Well, that's not the way it works. And the hotter the year and the more water you're using, the faster things decompose. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't advise just using it over and over and over without adding compost every year or two. But certainly don't just throw it all away.
Right. And I'm wondering, too, I mean, that potting soil, even if it's not good enough just to stay as it is, maybe doing moving half of it into a new pot, putting some compost in there, replacing that amount in the first pot with compost, and
yep, exactly.
Good to go.
Well, we throw away nothing. All of our potting mixes, because we do a lot of containers, in the fall we take and dump in all of the seasonal beds. And that adds to the porosity, the quality of those soils. And we still bring in compost as well. But that really helps a lot. So, you know, we're still reusing that, and it does add to the getting that good air and water mm-hmm. Space in the soil as well.
Well, speaking of not throwing anything out, Jamie in West Allis has a question about leaves. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This might be kind of a simple question, but I'm just itching to get at my garden.
Everybody is not alone.
Yeah.
Everybody is a month too early, unfortunately.
Sure. I have a window box right now that's heating everything up real nice. But last fall, I threw 2-3 inches of leaves all over my garden from fall tree fall. Would it be a good idea, in order to try to heat up my soil, to move those leaves back and then after that I'm going to cover it with plastic? Or should I just put the plastic right over the leaves?
I'm not sure. Are we talking vegetable gardening? Because I'm not sure why you have plastic.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just going to throw plastic over top of the soil to heat it up for my vegetables. Yes, I'm sorry.
Actually, if your vegetable garden has good quality organic matter in there, you don't even really need the plastic. It's kind of funny. I live on Main Street in a village just south of Madison here, and my garden goes right out to the street. I don't have any lawn. Everything's garden, as you can imagine. And the years of accumulating organic matter, the snow melts off my yard a week before anybody else's. And I've got these questions. What kind of a heating system do you have in the ground? Make sure if you've got good quality organic matter, when that warms up, that's the time to plant. You could fool yourself by putting plastic over there, over it to warm it up. And you may be, putting vegetables or plants in really before they should be going in. I know everybody gets itchy and they think, let's get out there and start planting things. I use leaves myself, and I put a good 4 to 6 inches over my perennial beds. I do that. That's my insulation factor in case we don't have snow cover. I don't take them off until about the middle of April. Mm-hmm. I know today we're saying 50 degrees. We think, the ground's warming up. But you notice we're also going back into cold temperatures. So if you push that process and you start getting these plants to go too soon, then you're going to be in trouble because they're going to be damaged as we go back into colder temperatures. So many people get antsy in April. April's for maybe some peas and some potatoes, but we really, truly aren't doing much in the way of gardening until we get into May. So I haven't really heard about warming up the soil with plastic, but if you've got good quality organic matter, that's going to warm up in a natural way for you, and then you'll know when is the right time to put those plants in.
Thanks for that call, Jamie. And we had an email from Victor. He has a clematis that doesn't bloom, so he'd like to dig it up and amend the poor soil, which he thinks is a problem. He's wondering if he can dig it up this spring after the soil thaws. Any other advice to get it to bloom because it gets plenty of sun?
Well, two things there. One is, yes, the best time to move most perennials is in the spring. Be aware of if it's a clematis with any age on it, it could have a pretty extensive root system. And if it does, damage that you do to that when you're digging it up, it might pout for a year or two afterwards. It kind of resents, it's very fibrous and it resents that disturbance. The other thing is clematis do like sun, but they also want their root systems kept cool and moist. And one of the mistakes people make is they let the area around that clematis get hot, let it get dry. They don't tolerate that. They don't want wet feet. but in the same regards they want them kept cool. So you need to mulch around your clematis every year. And don't get it right. You get all these caveats. That's right. How fussy the plant is. Don't get it right up around the plant. It'll rot the crown of the plant. But go out and around it with a good layer of mulch to keep the root systems moist. One of the reasons you may not be getting flowers is there's three different divisions of clematis. And they bloom, some of them bloom on new wood, some of them bloom on old wood. Mm. And if yours is late blooming into the season, anywhere from probably about late June into fall, it's blooming on new wood. Those you can cut right down to the ground, and all the new growth they put up will produce flowers. However, if you have an early blooming clematis and you're cutting all of that off, the new growth you're getting, they're not going to flower on that. They're right. Blooming on the old wood.
Well, and it also, if I'm reading this correctly, it sounds like Victor wants to take the plant out, amend the soil, and then put the plant back in the same place. But is there a way he can amend the soil without having to disturb it so much?
Not really, because it would involve building up around the clematis. And clematis don't like too much up and around their crowns once they've established. So he's probably, if he does it early in the season, and when it's the soil is still good and moist and amend it, it will help. But I'm thinking even more so than the amending is realizing what kind of soils that these plants want. They want well-drained yet evenly moist. I laugh. There's so many plants out there. To me, it's oxymoronic. You look at their ideal growing conditions, mm-hmm. and it's always evenly moist, well-drained soils. Right. And you're like, okay. So they've got to stay moist all summer, and yet they've got to be drained.
But it can't hold the water in too much.
Those are hard ones to get in the Midwest. We have very dry summers here that dry out our soils.
Good luck with that, Victor. Let's go back to the phones and Kim in Kiel. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question, I'm really happy to be on the show.
Good.
I listen to you every week. And my question is I have a fairly large garden, and in the spring after I've gotten done planting everything, when I start mowing the grass, I've been laying the grass clippings down in between the rows of vegetable plants. Is that okay to do?
It's okay to do. Generally, they advise you not to overdo on grass clippings. But if you heard the discussions before when we were talking about carbon to nitrogen ratios when we're doing compost or are building raised beds, they usually describe carbon as brown and nitrogen as green. So your green grass clippings would be adding some of the nitrogen component to that. I think usually what they say is just be careful of depth and overdoing it. But again, it's a form of organic matter. It breaks down fairly quickly, and you're adding organic matter. And again, you're recycling, which is a good thing.
Till it into the soil at the end of the year.
Yep. So you're putting organic matter back into your system.
All right. Thanks for that call, Kim. Let's go back to the phones and Michelle in Dodgeville. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to add a note on the whole straw bale idea. I have two large outdoor gardens that I've worked the soil to a beautiful state. However, they have I have had problems year after year with tomato blight, and this past season I decided to throw a few bales in and throw the tomatoes in the bales to get their feet out of that soil, as good as it is, and it was really a great success at avoiding the blight problem. So now, I just wanted to throw that out.
That would be an excellent suggestion. People that are having and blight's becoming quite an issue for us in the area.
Why is it becoming more of an issue?
Well, it's a fungal issue, and it's just just like anything else. It's taken that long to float its way out here to the Midwest, and you know, obviously, our warmer and more moist summers, we're going to see more issues with it as well. But she's exactly right, getting the root systems in something other than the soil where a lot of those fungal spores have accumulated probably help. And then once again, the grafted tomatoes will be much more resistant to the blight as well.
We were talking earlier, for those who might not have tuned in yet, about heirloom tomatoes that are grafted onto much hardier. What do you call non-heirloom tomatoes?
I just call it hardy root stock.
A hardy root stock. So kind of getting the best of both worlds there. Thanks for that comment, Michelle. And I think if there's anything that all of us want fresh out of the garden, it's a good tomato, don't you think?
Yeah, it's one of the things we wait all summer for.
Right, exactly. Well, I want to make sure that we talk about a few things going on at the garden. You have a new friends group for Allen Centennial Garden.
We do. We started it a year ago, and it's a wonderful group of people who are donating their time. Because we mentioned before that Allen Centennial Gardens is 100% self-supported, we want to start doing more activities, more events, more educational programming that I, as the only full-time person, couldn't do with some additional help and funding. So this group has gotten together to do that. We now have a member program. You can go on to our website. There's a page there to become a member of the gardens. If you become a member of the gardens, that money, of course, is supporting our ventures into having more offerings for people. But there's other things like a discount to the Wisconsin Gardening Magazine, discounts to events that we have. If you're a member, you can come to the winter classes that I do at no charge. So look at that page and see what the benefits are. But the thing we're really excited about this year is our new fundraiser. And do look, we have a page on the website called Posh Plants. And we have a fundraiser on June 14th. It's an auction, live and silent, unique and unusual garden plants and accessories.
And it's an auction.
It is.
That's
and in
great.
Fact, the live auction will be a runway show.
Really?
To generate excitement. And there'll be no tchotchke. It's all going to be really unique things you can't find in local garden centers.
Wow, the Posh Plants auction.
Yes.
We'll make sure all of that information is up on our Facebook page. Again, that's The Larry Mueller Show. And click like while you're there, because we want to get up to 7,000 likes before Larry is back on Monday. Ed Lyon is the director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. You can visit their website at allencentennialgardens.org. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in this week for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One of the joys of seeing a lovely garden is getting ideas for things we'd like to do in our own. But once we get home and want to get started, we may not really know what to do. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in this week for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network for Garden Talk. We're lucky to have an expert garden professional from the Allen Centennial Gardens with us to answer questions and offer suggestions, too. Ed Lyon is the director of the gardens, and we really appreciate when he comes by to spend time with us on Garden Talk. Ed, always great to see you.
Well, it's good to be here.
We're having fun today, aren't we?
We are.
As always.
It helps that it's such a beautiful day out.
It is. And it feels like we might actually get to garden kind of sort of soon.
Kind of sort of.
Kind of sort of. Well, let's go back to the phones. And Judy in Madison is up first. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Judith.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call. Ed, I have a kind of off-topic question for you, but this happens to me in spring. This question pops up. And that is, as I go outside and the snow is melting and the yard, I need to throw grass seed in. When's the earliest that I can start throwing out grass seed to rejuvenate the lawn? I have dogs, and spring is wonderful except for the mud.
Sure. And we will, as often we do, have Doug Soldat on a little later in the spring to talk about turf grass stuff.
Yeah, and turf is not my specialty. Like, I tell people, if you come to my house and you find any grass, it's either a weed or an ornamental.
Pull it out if you
see it. I have
it.
No lawn whatsoever.
But it's definitely early.
Yeah, you can put it down early. Keep in mind, though, and Doug could probably tell you better than I, it still seems a little bit early to me.
I think it's too early now.
Because you're going to get the spring rains that are going to displace that seed on you. I mean, that can be a bit of a challenge as well. Certainly isn't going to start germinating until we get a good deal more soil warmth than we have right. I mean, there's no such thing as soil warmth right now with the deep frost that we have. But again, I won't profess to be an expert on turf.
Nor will I, but I feel confident in saying it's too early now. But you might, Judy, look at the UW Extension Learning Store. I know they have some really good publications, several of them, I think, written by Doug Soldat about turf grass and lawns in Wisconsin. And I think you'll find some really good information there. So it's the UW Extension Learning Store for those. Let's go next to Connie in Portage. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I have a question. I'm not sure if it's a trumpet vine or a honeysuckle. Do I cut those clear to the ground? I mean, it's like 12 feet high and very woody.
Well, if it's vining, then it sounds more like the trumpet vine. Does it have a really long, almost 6-inch reddish-orange trumpet flower on it?
Yes, it does. The hummingbirds love it.
Yeah, that sounds to me like trumpet vine. I mean, trumpet vines can go on and on and on. I used to have a property where one grew all the way to the top of a telephone pole. Those folks weren't happy because they had to keep cutting it back. There's no need to cut it back unless you're trying to control the height on it. Is that what you're trying to do?
Yes, because it's, I mean, it's from the ground, and I have a big thing for it to climb, but it's going up to the roof of the house.
Yeah, and then go back in, and usually, just like any other woody plant that you're cutting, cut back to a bud, you know, determine where you want to go. One warning I'll give you, though, on trumpet vines, the more you cut on them, the more they're going to start sending out suckers. Like many plants, you start cutting on the top of them, they say, uh-huh, I'll get you then, and they'll start. And a trumpet vine can actually do a fair amount of suckering, and those suckers will go out fairly extensively. But certainly if it's getting to, and you can cut that back really good and hard and let
they're,
it get.
They're almost invasive,
yeah,
aren't they? They're
yeah,
really
I
vigorous.
I wouldn't be surprised if they don't end up on an invasive list somewhere down south. But
our next door neighbors have it on their house, and it's a really small house, and I fully expect one day to just see a lump of trumpet vine that's covered the entire house.
There's and I don't even know the folks, but where I live in Oregon, somebody has two on their front lawns that they have pruned into freestanding shrubs.
Really?
Yeah, and it's absolutely gorgeous. They're maybe about 5 to 6 feet high, and I thought, well, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But yes, they're very aggressive, very weighty. You could probably go out at any time now and cut on them and get that weight down.
Thanks for that call, Connie. And we have Jim calling from Texas. Hi, Jim.
All the way from Texas.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling from the hill country of Texas. I listen to you online, but we live in the Monaco area in the summertime. We split our time half and half. And
so you're sunbirds in Wisconsin instead of snowbirds down south.
We are sunbirds, yes. We spent 40 years living in Wisconsin full time, so we are happy to call ourselves Wisconsinites. My question is, when you use a herbicide on your lawn, like the 2,4-D Weed Be Gone products to kill the broadleaves, and then if you save that the grass clippings, does the herbicide carry over into the grass clippings and you compost it, and that would affect the vegetables then?
It could, yes. In fact, I am a big advocate of organic lawns. In fact, the two lawns that we have at the gardens, we have not used inorganic fertilizer or any form of pesticide on in I think 5 years now. We have probably the thickest, healthiest lawns that you could ever possibly see. That's a good point that I'm glad you brought up, because we had somebody call in earlier and was talking about putting grass clippings down in her yard. And because I'm so organically oriented, I forget. There's a lot of toxicity and a lot of people are applying 4 times a year on their lawns. And you do have to be aware. that those herbicides could have residual. You could be transferring some of that residual to your vegetable garden, raised bed, or wherever you're using them. My best advice is get away from the chemicals. It's easy to do. You'll have a better lawn in the long run, and our future generations will appreciate the fact that we're not contaminating the groundwater.
Thanks for that call, Jim, and we'll be happy to welcome you back to Wisconsin whenever you decide it's warmed up enough to make the trip north.
That might be July this year.
It might be July. You never know. Well, 2 years ago, this time of year, we had 80 degrees.
Yeah.
So you never know.
And that
know.
Was probably worse, actually. It was harder on plants, mm-hmm. that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones and Jan in Watertown. Hi, Jan.
Hi.
Hi.
Love the show today. It's a great show.
Good.
I have a question for Ed. Years ago, I'm 76, so we're talking a lot of years ago, my grandmother used to bury all the fruit and vegetable waste, like the leaves, the peelings, that type of thing, nothing else, in her garden. And I'm wondering if that's a good idea.
It's certainly all organic. It all becomes organic matter and a good way of disposing of such things. Certainly, if you're doing an extremely high concentration, then you're not balancing out the amount of decomposition and soil that you have in that garden. But essentially, all you're doing is taking what you would have thrown in the compost bin and you're putting it right directly in, and they would bury it so that it would decompose faster. Certainly nothing.
That's what I was wondering.
Yep, and nothing wrong with it. But again, it's interesting in a day and age when we're talking a lot about home composting. I was actually appalled recently. A very famous garden writer, who I know personally, that somebody quoted him as saying, "There's no such thing as bad compost." And I understand what he was getting at. It's the emphasis, compost, compost, compost. It's what makes our gardens better. But there is such a thing as bad compost. And too many times people think it's just a matter of throwing anything that decomposes into a pile, turning it every so often. And I was talking before about this ratio of carbon to nitrogen, brown to green. If you're not doing that correctly, you can actually create compost that will have bad, well, let's call them bad organisms, bad microorganisms. They're actually harmful to the soil. So I think anybody, this just brings up, because I know a lot of people are looking ahead at spring and doing their own compost, do a little bit of research or go to a class, because there are proper ways to do compost. And it isn't just simply a matter of, you know, just dumping a wide variety of things and letting them heat up, and that will become good compost for you.
Good. Thank you. Good advice.
Jan, what are you planning on planting this year?
Oh, well, basically, I do all flowers, and I do it at my church. I live in an apartment, so I have no garden space of my own. But I was thinking, you know, that I could dig some of this into the soil there. And I'm the only one in the house, so there wouldn't be a lot of of this, you know. But I was thinking, you know, and hearing Ed talk about things, I was remembering how my grandmother would do that, you know, because often my brother and I, that would be our job to go out and dig up a spot and put the potato peelings or whatever in it, you know.
And you know, Jan, actually, since you're just one person generating some peels and things like that, we had a question on Facebook about the benefits of worms and worm castings, and I think Jan should have a little worm bin in her apartment.
Yeah, there you go. They make them so you can put them right under your sink now.
And so to answer Eric's question about the benefits of worms, what is worm composting good for?
It's just another component that you put it back into the soil, and obviously earthworms are part of the whole microorganism, the biological activity that helps break down and create good soils. So there's a certain amount of nutrient value in worm castings, the organic matter. It adds to the porosity of the soils. Worm castings are excellent. We even use them in our raised vegetable beds.
And I'm just thinking, we've had people on to talk about both regular composting and vermiculture, the worm composting, and we haven't had someone on for a while, so that's something I should get on.
There you go.
Thanks for that call, Jan, and thanks for that question. Eric, you can join in at 1-800-642-1061. 1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk, talking with Ed Lyon, who's director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. We had an email from Jordan, and Jordan said, I'm looking into starting a community garden in our apartment complex. I've been researching herbs mainly and want to eventually start doing herbal healing, etc. Just wanted some resources to know where to start and the first steps now that it's spring. So I'd say first steps are preparing, regardless of what you're growing, is preparing that plot.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're doing raised bed gardening, you can start much earlier than if you're going to be gardening in the ground. And I'm not sure where Eric is from.
Yeah, it doesn't say, actually.
Madison has an herb society. And the folks in the Herb Society, I'm sure, would be more than happy to help anybody that has questions about herbs. They're a great group of people. And I'm sure even if you're not in the Madison area, those folks would still be more than willing to help you out. Growing herbs is a lot of fun. We have an herb garden at Allen Gardens ourselves. And it's really fun once you get into researching all the different uses. There's many, many resources out there, books, internet. You'll find there's no lack of information on herbs, their value, and how to grow them.
And I was just remembering, we had a guest on Garden Talk. I want to say it's a couple of years ago, a year and a half or so ago, Marguerite Ramlow, R-A-M-L-O-W. She's with the Artha Sustainable Living Center. I believe that she was actually on with Larry broadcasting from the Midwest Renewable Energy Association event up in Custer. And so you might want to look up Marguerite Ramlow. She grows a lot of herbs, and especially dries herbs, and uses them in a variety of healing things and also culinary things. So there's a good resource, too. Let's go back to the phones and Roger in Little Chute. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Last fall, I had two big maple trees that had tar spots. And then when the leaves fell, I ground them up with the lawnmower and everything else, put them on my garden and tilled them in. Then I found out I shouldn't have done that.
No, you shouldn't have, Roger. in fact, Roger, you should subscribe to Wisconsin Gardening Magazine. I write the Ask the Expert column in there, and tar spot was one of the questions that we addressed. Tar spot is caused, and it was really bad last fall. In fact, the village of Oregon, where I lived, almost every maple tree had it. Mm. It's a fungal issue, very similar to anthracnose. You're going to get it in those years when you have the wet, moist conditions. The next year could be entirely, dry, and you'll never see it again. The reason that you shouldn't be transferring them to other areas or grinding them back up is they're full of spores, all those fungal spores. The advice is when you have diseases like that, is to rake up all of the debris that those spores would be in. Now, they can survive for very, very long times. They can be transported in air very long distances. Anytime you have fungal diseases, clean up and get rid of as much of the fallen vegetation as you can. Not much you can do about it at this point. I don't think it's going to really affect anything dramatically. It won't transfer to vegetable plants. It's a specific fungus. But in the future, I would certainly clean up that debris and get rid of it.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Roger. Good luck with that. And Ed, speaking of disease, were there any diseases or pests that you dealt with a lot in the gardens last year?
Last year, probably the one that that really affected us the most is this squash borer. We got only in the last couple of years have we seen vine weevils and squash borers. And again, we had this big, wonderful gourd arbor, and I didn't notice right offhand. And boy, once those borers start getting in
and
there.
And so they bore into the stalk, and then it just kind of withers
right
there. And it's usually pretty low to the ground, right?
So, exactly. This year, when we plant the plants, we'll probably put like a little plastic cup right around them when we plant. But it's something that we weren't dealing with in the past. And we keep seeing this influx of new things. We didn't used to have the tomato blight. light that we had. You know, there's certain things that the good news is at least the Japanese beetles weren't so bad. We actually had a Rose of Sharon that got to bloom without all the buds being damaged. But last year wasn't particularly bad. It was more probably insects last year than diseases.
Than diseases. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones and Han in Waukesha. Hi, Han.
Hello.
Hi.
My first name is Dee, but my last name is Han.
Oh, okay.
I was just going to tell you an interesting thing that I just did. We had a garden, and I had some carrots in it, so we picked all the big carrots out and ate them, but there was a lot of little carrots left. So I covered it with straw from a straw bale that fell apart, and shortly after that it snowed. Just today I dug up fresh big carrots from my little patch of carrots, and they're sweet. It is unreal. Best carrots I ever grew. I think I have to grow them all over the last.
You know, Larry has said that too, that the overwintered carrots, it must do something with the sugar.
I think it does. It increases the sugar content. I grew up on a farm, and this was the time of year we went out and dug up those leftover carrots and the parsnips. My grandfather couldn't wait till we could go out and it was... the soil was such that we could, and again, that's certainly possible with a lot of root crops, and it's important to make sure you have good organic matter in your vegetable gardens, so you have that drainage so the water doesn't sit around them and all that excess rot them out. But you have a good quality garden and good quality garden soil, some of those root crops will be there for you in the spring.
And Dean also said that he put some, decomposed straw bale over the top. So is insulating those root crops still in the ground important to you?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and you don't get the alternating freezing and thawing of the soil that breaks everything up so badly.
Kent emailed, please provide advice about treating dodder. I found some in my yard last year. I removed all vegetation around it, bagged it in a black contractor bag, and put it in the garbage.
In all honesty, I know dodder, and it is a parasitic plant. But
it's a plant itself. Okay.
Yes, it is. And to tell you the truth, I've never had to deal with it, and I've never had to answer that question. So again, I think your extension would probably be your resource for that.
Again, that's a UW Extension Learning Store. But if it's so, it's a did you say a parasitic plant?
Yeah, it is. It's much like mistletoe in that it's actually living off other plants.
So in general, though, if you find something that, for instance, is an invasive or something like garlic mustard, what are kind of the best practices for getting it out of the garden and making sure you're not just moving it somewhere else?
Well, garlic mustard in particular, any of those types of plants, they'll tell you to bag them in black plastic bags and let them heat up. So they literally, you're destroying the plant and you're not then taking it to a compost site and adding to that problem. Seeds aren't the only things that can regenerate. A lot of plant tissue can as well. And we have to be careful of what we're transferring from one area to another.
Mm-hmm. And in just the last couple of minutes here, let's remind people you have a family gardening day coming up on Saturday, May 10th. What will be going on?
We do. It's actually event that's put on by Science Alliance here on campus. D.C. Smith Greenhouses, which are part of the Hort Department, Steenbach Library, and Allen Centennial Gardens are all part of this. We invite families of all types to come in. There's a variety of activities that we do, teach people about gardening, about plants. We hand out little four packs of vegetables at D.C. Smith. Come over to Allen Centennial Gardens. We help the kids plant up one of them in a cow pot. We create nursery necklaces that they can wear around their neck and germinate a bean seed. We have things for adults. We have a group of master gardeners who came out last year to show adults low-impact gardening tools. They had some really fascinating tools. They had a dandelion digger that you didn't have to bend.
Wow.
And I said, there's no way this thing could get the entire root out of a dandelion, and darned if it... They did all my weeding for me early.
just showing off their tools.
So it's 10 to 2 on May 10th, free to the public. Come on out, and especially if you have children or grandchildren, but even if you don't have children, it's a great activity.
Sounds like fun. fun. Well, we will make sure there's information about the Family Gardening Day. There's also a hosta sale on May 24th, and then in June, the Posh Plant Auction. We'll make sure all of that is up. Ed Lyon, as always, thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me. We love to share information and advice.
Ed Lyon is the director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus, and he has been since 2008. We love when he joins us on Garden Talk. Well, coming up on Monday, Larry is back, and he'll find out at 11 about the economic and cultural benefits of our state parks. And then at 11:45 on Monday, UW is a top source of Peace Corps volunteers. We'll talk about the Peace Corps experience. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us.